Do we have a quorum? House Labor and Commerce is called to order at 3:30, 2:30. For the record, we have Representative Crawford, Representative Lynn, Representative Rogberg, myself. We do have the bare minimum, but we do have it. The first bill we're going to take up today, since it's the chairman's bill, he has that prerogative, is House Bill 477. There is a CS that has been prepared, and Representative Lynn, if you can move it, we can at least talk about it. If you read it, it'd be better.
Okay, here we go. Mr. Chairman, I move a CS for House Bill number 477 for discussion. It's 24-LS1696-G, and it's by somebody called Representative Todd.
That's Luckup.
Luckup? He's going back to Luckup.
Okay, hearing no objection, we have the version G before the committee, and we have the staff to the sponsor. That's ready to provide some comments on the bill. Mr. O'Hare, would you please state your name, Michael O'Hare, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Mike O'Hare, staff to Representative Pete Cott, and before you is HB 477, an act relating to charitable gaming. This bill is an effort to ensure that crimes within the charitable gaming community are investigated and prosecuted fully and passionately. It also, with many of these charities affected by these crimes, they're discouraged by the results of investigations and lack of prosecutions of these cases in the past. HB 477 changes Alaska Statute 0515-010, requiring the Department of Public Safety to investigate these issues and reports, and the Attorney General to prosecute these crimes. This requirement will hopefully deter criminal activity associated with charitable gaming and keep it clean. And all of the charities involved will get their fair and rightful share of the proceeds. HB 477 also adds provisions to the existing charitable gaming statute that will enable permittable charitable gaming organizations and operators to present to the state biennial reports instead of the annual reports currently required by law. Currently, both the state and gaming operators must expend considerable resources each December to process and prepare permits and renewals. Changing to biennial reporting will be much more effective and efficient for everyone. The permittee currently expends considerable resources to prepare each annual permit application. The state spends considerable resources examining each permit application. The state loses neither revenue nor enforcement capability with this change. HB 477 also amends AS 0515090 to include the department's detailed report containing a summary of all reports required of permittees and operators. This report must also include information concerning any investigations or prosecutions undertaken by the Department of Public Safety or the Department of Law as required under the amended statute. HB 477 also removes the Alaska Administrative Code 160580 sub E. This code refers to the allowable number of bingo games and limitations on the number of bingo sessions, as well as a 1 hour break between the bingo sessions. This section was originally enacted to prevent the so-called bingo wars, where competing organizations would raise payouts in order to compete with other games. This 60-minute break is inconvenient, expensive, and inefficient. Players must sit and wait for about an hour. Bingo is a social event in many communities. This mandatory halt disrupts the process, as the stoppage is in no way connected to the schedules of the people that gather to play. It inhibits the tempo of the evening. Removing the section will allow operators to adjust to the tempo and schedules of their customers. With regard to the hour break, utilities are being run, the lights and the heat are on, and the staff must wait while still getting paid that 60-minute period. The removal of this section will increase the enjoyment for those participants in bingo and reduce the costs associated with providing the service. Any reduction of the cost would benefit those charities that deserve the proceeds. There are three fiscal notes, one from the Department of Revenue, one from the Department of Public Safety, and one from the Department of Law. That concludes my introduction, Mr. Chairman. I'm available for questions, but there are experts in charitable gaming activities that I'm sure would be much better to testify on technical issues than I, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Are there questions? Seeing none, Representative Lynn?
I'm just curious, among several things, but especially the, you know, going from 1 year to 2 years, it looks like you have to wait twice as long to take a look to find out if something is improper. You know, wouldn't it be better if something is improper to catch it after 1 year rather than having to wait 2 years to find it?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, it's my understanding that the permittees will still be required to submit an annual summary report to the Department of Revenue. Sir.
Representative Crawford, you look puzzled.
I had it brought to my attention about the 60-minute timeout, that if we remove the 60-minute timeout, that it will allow more games, more gambling, more revenues for the operators, less money for the people that are out there playing, and that the night gets shorter. I don't know that I would like to see there be more revenues, more money in the system than there is now. I think it takes a huge chunk of people's disposable income as it is, from people that have the least to put into it. And I can tell you I'm opposed to anything that expands on gambling. Is that not the outcome?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I would like to refer to other members of Charitable Game to see if they can answer their perspective on that, sir.
Thank you.
Only in response, it would be my understanding that if you had an afternoon and evening session, and the operators, I think, probably someone from the industry can clarify this, the operators establish a number of games. So say it's you buy a $30 pack for 30 games, and that's the session. After that person plays that session, if they want to stick around and play the next one, they have to wait for an hour. I suppose you could conceivably expand the number of games. However, I would suspect that as an operator of bingo, you could expand and do a third session, or you could, I don't know what the restrictions are for 24-hour operation. Maybe there are ordinances in various communities that restrict that, but I don't think you're going to see a great degree of expansion, because I think there's opportunity now to expand the number of sessions and games, but maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Mr. Bob Lozier come up and comment on these.
Mr. Chairman, what other witnesses do we have that are going to be?
We have
is there somebody from the department? Or other
we've got a member from the Department of Revenue. We have the troopers and Rokeberg staff. We have revenue and the troopers and members of the industry, at least one. If there's no further questions, then thank you, Mike. Maybe, I don't know, would the committee like to hear from the department first, revenue? Maybe they can clarify through regulation or statute maybe some of your questions.
That'd be fine with me.
Okay. Why don't we then go to Mr. Meyer. Larry, are you online?
Yes, I am. My name is Larry Myers. I'm the Deputy Director with the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. And I have with me Dick Tremaine, who is our economist, if you should have any questions on that portion of the fiscal note. And also in the audience, I have Jeff Prather. And Jeff, if you could join us at the table.
He just left. No, he's
he
here. He's at the table.
Okay, Jeff's at the table. Okay, and if you have any specific questions, you know, we'll certainly respond to them.
Maybe the question that Representative Crawford asked, I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer it, but did you understand his question and kind of my haphazard response, because I'm not a bingo player?
Through the chair, yes, I believe I did. And Jeff, would you address how many sessions that can be run and just give the committee an overview of how it works?
Mr. Chairman, the sessions are limited to 35 games or $5,000 in payouts. Sessions are limited to 35 games or $5,000 in payouts. And there can be no more than 4 sessions in a 24-hour period.
Okay, so then I was essentially on the right track in the sense that you've got 35 games. That's the max you can play, or up to $5,000 payout per session?
Per session.
And there are 4 sessions, so if you shorten those sessions to 10-minute breaks in between, you would still have the same 35...
Same limitation.
Same limitation of $5,000, or 35 games and $5,000.
Per session, that's
per
correct.
Per session. So does that answer your question, Representative Crawford?
Sort of. I've got another follow-up that I don't quite understand, and I'm going to try to ask the question as best I can. Also, with the 60-minute timeout, apparently, if you do away with that, it allows you the use of a bingo gaming machine. And if you could explain that to me and let me know what the pros and cons of that would be.
I Representative Crawford, I don't know anything about bingo gaming machines being available between sessions.
Jeff, do we have those in the state? Bingo gaming machines?
There are electronic, what we call electronic bingo paper. They're machines that you can daub numerous cards. And the machine keeps track of everything for you. But I'm not sure what Representative Crawford is referring to when he's talking about bingo machines.
I'm not sure either. It was just a complaint that came in to my office. And it said that doing away with the 60-minute timeout would also allow the use of bingo gaming machines. I was concerned that, you know, you may be doing away with somebody's job. I don't know. I just wanted to explain what that really means.
Representative Crawford, if I might try,
go ahead, Larry.
The traditional gaming or bingo that we see is oftentimes played with real bingo paper, and I think part of the hour break was to allow closure of a game, you know, because you've got all this paper, allows the awarding of the prizes, and then, you know, people that take an actual break, go get something to eat, go to the restrooms, and then go back and buy new paper for the next game. And as we move into electronics, it speeded things up, and I think that's what you're hearing is that you can buy with electronic bingo paper. You can play more games. It's on paper, and it speeds up the play. And there has been some effort out there to bring in new types of machines that would, you know, literally allow you to continuously play. And I think that's probably what your constituent was talking about.
Thank you. Larry, would those new types of machines then have to be approved by the department?
Yes, they would. And the, you know, the department constantly sees new products that are coming out, and we're trying to match our statutes and regulations with their machines and try to see if they fit the intention and the purpose of the gaming statutes.
It would seem to me, Larry, with some of these new products that are coming out, and I only can revert back to, gosh, when I was 10 years old in the Catholic Church in the back, where they were spinning this little cage and the balls would come out and they'd put them on a rack, and compare that to today where the balls are circulating via air and automatically come out down a chute, pick it up, you call the number, you put it in a ball holder, and it lights up the number on the board. So it would seem to me that with technology advancing the way it has, that these bingo sessions probably have become a little bit shorter over the years than perhaps what they were a while back. But regardless of that, there is still the restriction in between the sessions. There's still a number of sessions that you can have as an operator, and there's still a number of games and total prize payout that still is part of the equation which you cannot exceed. I was thinking Representative Crawford was talking about some kind of electronic on-the-table type of machine where in between the sessions a player could go put a quarter in and play bingo and punch in numbers, but evidently that's I'm out of the loop. Representative Crawford plays more bingo than I have. But nonetheless, Representative Roakberg?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to get clear on the Section 9 of the CS. We're nullifying a regulation 15 AAC 160.580. I noticed in the bill package it had a which looks like a iteration of that regulation here, A through E. And what the bill does is I take it, if this is correct, it repeals, is it just the E section, subsection E? Let me look at that there. Can we get that?
Just subsection E.
Oh, it's just only subsection E, which is the break. So the other time frames are still going to be inexistent in regulation. So you chose not to adopt them by statute or anything like that. You just were annulling the one subsection. Okay, I have it clear now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other further questions? Representative Lynn?
Well, I guess I'd like somebody testifying here to talk to me about going from the 1 year to the 2 years. Any other comment, any other opinions on that from what we've heard so far?
Larry, can you comment or someone from the department comment on going from a 1 to 2 year reporting period?
Yes, to the chair.
What's the advantage? What's the disadvantages?
Well, I would say that as the sponsor said, you know, they're by having it on an annual basis. Obviously, we, the division, as the regulator, you know, want to stay on top of the activity, and by using annual reports and matching those up with the operators with what the permittees are, you know. It has made our job easier. Granted, we have a lot more paperwork. We obviously, as a regulator, would want to see everything done as perfect as possible. What's going to happen now is that we're going to have to rely on reports from the permittees. And, you know, if there is action to be taken against an operator or his bond, then, you know, in theory, we're not going to be able to act immediately because we're going to have to wait until that final report is filed, which could be 2 years, out. And, you know, as a regulator, you know, that makes our jobs a little more tough, and especially if the public comes in and raises a complaint. You know, we can always continuously look at their books and audit them, but we don't have a physical summation. And the same thing with the CPA report. Normally they're done on an annual basis, and now it would be based on 2 years worth of activity, and CPAs can do that again, but again, you know, having timely information and having it verified. So, you know, it's a possibility that if you stretch it out, that if there is an issue, that we will not be able to act as timely, and as well as other law enforcement and the prosecuting attorneys. I mean, that is one of the downsides. If everything works fine, and there's no problems, then, it can work.
Thank you. Representative Lynn?
Well, at the proper time, I may want to offer an amendment to change it to the current 1 year for all the both for the report and anything else we have, and back to what it is now. You can tell me, Mr. Chairman, you think that might be an appropriate time to,
okay,
to offer a conceptual amendment.
Any further questions, Representative Crawford?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to leave here for a while to go be on a program. So I'm sorry, but I, I got to go. I hope to be back after a little bit.
Your excuse.
All right.
Any further questions for the department? Okay, thank you, Larry. If you would just hang by in case there's any other questions.
And we will. Thank you,
Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, next go to Mr. Loescher. We kept you waiting long enough.
Yeah, my notes. Thank you, Chairman Cott, and thank you for your staff assistance and also the coordination that we've had in working with the Department of Revenue on some technical changes. My name is Bob Loescher. I'm a vice president of Juneau A&B Camp Number 2. We have charitable gaming permits and operate here in Juneau. We are supportive of House Bill 477 and would like to advance some comments to support the various provisions of the bill. The business of the biennial reports are sort of important because every year at the last week of December, the charitable gaming entities, which exceed 1,200 entities across the state, have to scramble around to refile their permit application to get their year-end report. They have to work with their accountants to make sure everything's in order. And for charitable gaming organizations, which consist of volunteers and whatnot, this is kind of a pressurized time. For the department, they receive all of these reports and permit applications and everything all at once, and so they're having to respond as well. And so we are requesting, and which is included in the bill, the idea of biennial reports. Every 2 years they get a summary report of what is going on. Mr. Chairman, this does not negate the quarterly reports that the department gets from every charitable gaming organization across the state. So they receive quarterly reports. This would not have set aside the 1% fee that the state gets for revenue from the charitable gaming organizations, because they would get those funds as well. We're not recommending to change those laws. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, the fees that the charitable gaming permittees pay, and the operators and the other people, would be paid 2 years in advance. So the state would be getting their money in advance as well, as the way the bill is currently drafted. And we believe that one additional thing that the department in their comments recommended to your staff was the notion that those permit applicants who have an even number year application would start their two-year biennial report in 2007, and those that have the odd one would be 2008. So that would diminish the impact on the department as well, and also set up a sequence with the charitable gaming organizations to make this flow a lot better and more efficiently. And Mr. Chairman, we believe that this would help charitable gaming. It would help keep their costs down. The reporting would be ongoing on a quarterly basis. The state would get their 1% annual fee, and they would also get the permit application fee 2 years in advance. So that's the effect of your bill as well. Where are we at?
Bob, you want to take questions as we go along?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, however you want to do this.
I've got a question. you brought up something that I wasn't aware of. I knew about the annual reporting requirements, but you also mentioned there's a quarterly report.
Yes, sir.
Can you give the committee some idea as to what both of those consist of? I mean, are they very similar, or is the quarterly report just a snapshot of the overall playing field?
Mr. Chairman, the quarterly report has within it all the aspects that would be an annual summary report. In it, it delineates the revenues that were gained and the activities of the charity during that whole quarter, and we file that every quarter, and our accountants also review that, and we file that to the department. And then the annual report is just a summary of those, the four quarter reports. All we're saying, Mr. Chairman, is that we would continue with the quarterly reports to the department, which they get all the time, but the big summary, you know, for the 2 years would be at the end of the 2 year period, and we would be able to break the charities apart to odd and even year of their date of their first application and help spread that load to the administration a little bit better. In effect, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that the department would be able to have more time and more ability to deal with the reporting of the charities than the way it's coming in on a lump sum basis right now on the annual reports, and deal with the fees and permit costs that would be all paid in advance. So I think it would be a benefit to the state, is our view of it.
So under this bill, then, you would have a two-year report that would be a compilation of the previous eight quarters.
Yes, sir, that is correct.
At which point, any time during those previous eight quarters, if there was an anomaly in that report, that quarterly report that was submitted to the Department of Revenue, they could pick up on that and analyze or review it, scrutinize it, whatever they wanted to do with it.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Question.
Representative Lynn.
A little clarification. I don't understand this. So we have the quarterly reports, and they're exactly the same thing as the annual or biannual report?
Yes, just a
Why
summary.
Why do we have, then, the annual report or biannual report? Am I missing something here?
Let's get rid of them. Was that your amendment?
No, we haven't had it yet. I may modify it, but I mean, what? I don't get that. It's the very same thing, except a different column?
Mr. Chairman, it does bring all the four quarters together. In summary,
it adds them up,
and is helpful to the department for reporting to the legislature about how much revenues it's making. It still can gather that information, but there's no difference. The quarterly reports are merely a summary, or the annual report is merely a summary of the quarterly reports, and it's all on one sheet or sheets. And there would be no change.
Well, I'd like to talk to the administration about that later.
Okay.
Yeah, and you do have the amendment to get rid of the annual report?
Well, not yet. I don't have an amendment to get rid of an amendment that's not there yet, but I may think of something else in the meantime.
Please.
Any further questions at this
not
point?
Not at the moment.
Okay, Mr. Losher, you may continue.
Okay, what is the format now?
Conforming
to Mr. Chairman, additionally, after we did our first work on the bill and we worked with your staff in the department was very helpful in advising of conforming amendments that had to be made in various sections of the statute. And so we have advanced to you and to the department, and I believe that your CS has picked up all those conforming changes throughout the statute dealing with this biannual reporting. For permittees and operators and what's the other one? Co-ops. And so, Mr. Chairman, there was a number of places that conforming amendments had to be made, and I believe the legislative legal has identified those after we had to advance some drafting to that effect. Okay, where am I at? Okay, we already talked about that. What's this one? Mr. Chairman, something that has been very difficult for the charitable gaming organizations, and there is absolutely no recourse in the law at this time, when there is theft or embezzlement within the charitable gaming community from workers or other things that happen, It's very, very difficult to get anybody to investigate these at the police, the local police level in the community, and with the Department of Public Safety, and then going to the Attorney General's office or district attorney. We have not been able to get any assistance. And charitable gaming, as with any and all other businesses, we do have thefts and embezzlements, and we have not been able to get these prosecuted and to get any recovery of losses. And this has been very difficult to charitable gaming organizations who are basically voluntary nonprofit entities. What we are concerned about, Mr. Chairman, is that we need something in the law that would allow charities to go to the Department of Public Safety and to local police to have these cases investigated. And we need to, if those those cases after investigation warrant prosecution, that the Attorney General and the District Attorney could determine whether they should be prosecuted. This is an important thing to charitable gaming organizations. Some of the other after effects, because we're unable to get public safety or the police to investigate these cases and get them prosecuted, our fidelity bond coverage is very limited if we're not able to get a record of the theft or embezzlement. And so we're able to only partially recover or not recover from our fidelity bond coverage that the nonprofit organizations are paying for. And also, it's very difficult for us if we're unable to, because we're a volunteer fraternal and nonprofit organizations, if people don't take us seriously, employees and other people who are stealing from the charities, if they don't take our organization seriously, we continually to get robbed, and they don't respect that they will go to jail or lose their jobs or whatever. And so what we're asking, Mr. Chairman, is that if the legislature could provide the provision that's included in your bill to allow the Department of Public Safety and local police to investigate, and if these are meritorious, to have the Attorney General, the District Attorney, prosecute these cases, and that will benefit the charities greatly and also the state and the public. And we humbly request that you consider that addition to the charitable gaming statute.
Mr. Loescher, without exposing the name of the operator or an employee, can you give the committee a concrete, real-life example of perhaps...
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Individual ...that may have done something that shouldn't have been done?
Yeah, I just became an officer of the Juno AMB this last year, and on our officer group was in a meeting one day, and they were very chagrined as to what had occurred. One of our key employees that had worked for us for 12 years, we gave her the job as the manager for the gaming operations of our fraternal organization, and she embezzled in excess of $50,000 from our organization. And we gathered with our accountants all of the information, all of the checks, all of the stuff that we had. We gave it to the local police, and to this date we have not been able to get any action out of the police department or the state to help us prosecute this case. And our Fidelity Bond Company has been willing only to offer us a small measure, like $4,000 against the loss that we incurred. And that whole thing trickles down all the way through our organization when this happens. And so that's the one I'm most familiar with since I've been an officer, and it's only been a year or so that I've been an officer.
Has there been any response as to why there hasn't been any action taken?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, basically what we're able to derive out of the conversation is that investigating these kinds of crimes is a very low priority, and prosecuting these kind of crimes, and we have made inquiries to the Attorney General's office in the past, is a very low priority as well. And there's nothing compelling in the statutes, or nothing authorizing in the statutes for the Department of Public Safety or the Attorney General's office or district attorney. There's nothing in the statute that gives them authority to get involved in these kind of things directly.
Would a white collar crime such as what you're alluding to fall underneath the jurisdiction of the state or the local authorities?
Mr. Chairman, we believe it falls under the jurisdiction of the state. Okay. Where are we?
Why the state and not the locals?
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
State law, that is, or what?
Charities are enabled and authorized and permitted by state statute. Local governments are not involved in authorizing charitable gaming. It's a matter of state concern.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
Juneau would have to have a local ordinance that they broke. Forcing, so it has to be.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Losha, how many of these types of offenses have you heard about or maybe become aware of where you can surmise on an annual basis how many offenses would then be turned over to the Department of Public Safety? And the only reason why I'm asking this is we are mandating that the Department of Public Safety should investigate these, and then that the Department of Law shall prosecute. So we are having them perhaps shift their burden of responsibility from whatever they're working on, whether it's oil and gas stuff, over to this particular aspect. I'm just wondering how much of their time would be consumed in doing so. I mean, we're talking about 50, 100 violations, two or three.
Mr. Chairman, based upon what I've done in research, at least in the organizations in our community in general, maybe there are two or three in a 5 to 7 year period, but when it happens, it's a lot of money, and it really impacts the charities. A lot of the work, at least the one I've been involved in, and then the historic research that I've done, is that the charities are willing to put all the information together and as much as they can and work with the local police to do the investigation, but when they get into the local police, it seems not to go anywhere in the police department investigations arena. So we don't know why they get stalled or they're not prosecuted. We as citizens or organizations don't have the ability to sue. We haven't found any way to do so. To do it on our own behalf. So that's why we're asking the state to assist the charities with dealing with these thefts and embezzlements. Okay, where are we at?
Prosecution.
Okay.
Authority of Department of Law to prosecute.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Violations.
Okay.
Charities are non-profit,
okay.
The capacity to gauge investigation.
Right. I've said all the stuff on my notes.
legislation knows regulation 100.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I was hoping that the gentleman, the representative who was concerned about the one-hour break would be here, but I'd like to comment on that just briefly. Mr. Chairman, the one-hour break is between if a charitable gaming has more than organization has more than one session. One session is limited to $5,000, and in our community, the session only has 13 games in them, not the total of how many?
45.
45, because sheer time limits how many games you can have. And sometimes once every 3 months or so, they'll have a day where they have a special day with two sessions in it. At least in Juneau, that's our experience. In Anchorage and other places, they might have three or four sessions during a day. But in our community, we have two, and they're limited. In Juneau, for instance, where my experience is, we end up with this 1 hour in between sessions. And because of the bus schedule, people are inconvenienced. Elderly people who come to our bingo and other people are inconvenienced. They have to sit there for an hour. And, you know, we have to do other activities. We have to incur the cost for the hall, for the workers and whatnot. And it's an inconvenience to our customers as well as to our organization. It increased the costs. And what we would like is to ask that this regulation be annulled, because we believe that the cause of having this this regulation established in rulemaking in the first place probably has diminished, and the Anchorage people will have to speak for themselves, but we believe that it has diminished. But it's a rule of general application across the state, and in our community we feel that that rule is an imposition and inconvenient to our customers and ourselves. And we would hope that the rule could be annulled. Now, the reason we asked you, Mr. Chairman, to include that in the bill, the sponsor's bill, is because we understand that the rule came out of a task force that the department had organized several years ago, and it was a very difficult issue during that time. And we believe that the department would not be terribly persuaded to delete that rule very easily. And it appears to me that it's a better course for us to present it to the legislature and ask them to annul that rule, and we could go back to the way we want to manage it on a more efficient basis between sessions. Now, sessions in our community, we don't hold more than one session a day, a gaming organization, but once every quarter we'll have a day where we have special bingo and have two sessions, but that hour in between is inconvenient. So we would hope that the legislature would annul that regulation. Okay, take that away. Okay, Mr. Chairman, those are basically are the reasons that we're supporting the bill, and we're available to any legislature or any committee to clarify anything that we presented here, and we ask the legislature to adopt this legislation. Mainly it's administrative, except for the issue of investigating and prosecuting thefts and embezzlements. That's a new feature, but the rest of it is administrative.
Thank you, Bob. Representative Roegberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to thank Mr. Lozier for the coming before this committee. I've sat on the committee for 12 years now. I just wanted to thank him for the many times that he's given of his time to come before us and on various different issues, I might add, and at inconvenience to himself. I want to thank him for that.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Bob.
Okay.
On behalf of the committee for taking the time, as Representative Roegberg has already conveyed to you. Next, we'll go to Mr. Jack Powers.
Jack, this is Jack Powers. Can I make a special request through the chair?
You bet.
That I follow Steve Borringer in his testimony. I believe he's in Anchorage at the LIO office, and I think our testimony would go hand in glove and make more sense if he went first.
That was Steve Borringer?
Right. Borringing. He's
okay, I got Mr. Borringing here.
Yeah, he's sitting in the LIO office in Anchorage, and I'm online.
Okay, then we'll go to the LIO in Anchorage, Mr. Steve Borringing.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is, for the record, is Stephen Borkerding. I know it's a tough name. I'm the general manager of Gold Cash Bingo here in Anchorage, Alaska. I am also currently a member of the House Gaming Task Force. So some of these things kind of cross over a little bit. I have prepared testimony that I submitted to the assistant for this particular committee, and I don't know if you have it in front of you or not. I'd like to read it and probably add a few little things that I've written down as I've been listening.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm here today to express my concerns about HB 477 and ask that you do not, or that you not pass this bill out of this committee. I cannot foresee any significant benefit to the charities or the regulators of this industry in its three basic sections. My concerns are as follows. Public safety requirement. The Department of Revenue is already tasked with and is required to investigate any complaints by the charitable gaming industry or its consumers. HB 477 requires, not allows, requires all complaints of theft or embezzlement to be handled by the Department of Public Safety and would eliminate the investigative powers and duties of the Department of Revenue, specifically the gaming unit with regard to theft. Theft and embezzlement are already under the jurisdiction of public safety. The Department of Revenue does not have jurisdiction over these criminal acts, but it does have the ability to investigate the claims, build cases, utilize its judgment, and based on its expertise in this area, present its findings to the proper authorities. Under HB 477, any complaint of theft or embezzlement, whether justified or not, will be immediately turned over to the department to a department that does not have the expertise or the resources to properly investigate these claims. Additionally, Section 5 of House Bill 477 provides for essentially a blotter report of ongoing investigations. Since the power of reasonable judgment by the Department of Revenue is removed, and any and all complaints, justified or not, about organizations, individuals, or operations will show up on this report. Ongoing operations and individuals may be victimized by erroneous complaints, bad publicity, or unscrupulous competitors. I'm a huge proponent of keeping gaming free of corruption, so I believe in keeping the investigative powers in the hands of the experts. Okay, the next section is biennial reporting. The industry itself, for the most part, has made it clear that we are not in favor of loosening regulations or restrictions. We have continually shown through our actions that we not only support tighter regulations, we actually help the Department of Revenue draft and implement them. HB 477 not only loosens some restrictions, it may actually promote or open the door to large-scale corruption. Biennial reporting creates holes in the system that may be exploited. According to the Department of Revenue, the majority of issues investigated by the gaming unit are as a direct result of current reporting requirements. The gaming unit's investigations or audits of reports are the best tool they have for deterring illegal activity. More importantly, according to the gaming unit, these reports are used quite often to assist permittees with their various gaming activities. The gaming unit routinely uses its reports to help educate permittees on the rules and regulations, resulting in a cleaner and more profitable industry. In addition, HB 477 does not make provisions or change other statutes, although I don't have the CS in front of me and this may have been changed. Biennial reporting, licensing, operator contracts, odd year application reports by self-directed or MVP organizations, odd year charities with an MVP scenario, biennial state gaming reports, as well as the formidable amount of regulations that will have to be rewritten. The proponents of this bill have insisted that biennial reporting will relieve the Department of Revenue of some of its burden. The bill, however, only seems to apply to operators. There are only 22 operators in Alaska, and there are 1,200 total permittees. I do not see the significant relief of burden. In fact, this legislation would create more of a burden, according to the Department of Revenue. And one of the things that was brought up in the previous testimony was that quarterly reports are the same as the annual report. That is not completely true. The annual report is an audited report by a CPA. The quarterly reports are not. So the annual report may show differences that the quarterly reports, even if they're all combined together, may not show. I do not believe this section will relieve the Department of Revenue of any of its workload, and it will more than likely create additional work, especially auditing. It will open up an avenue for large-scale corruption, especially in the hands of an unscrupulous operator. and it will hinder the department's ability to assist struggling charities. And that's one of the parts of the department that, that these reports really help. Not everybody, especially people who don't have as sophisticated as operations as I might have or some of the other people testifying, and just don't have a plain business sense in some respects. The Department of Revenue has done a wonderful job of helping those charities through reading their reports to be able to do their to be able to stay in compliance and become profitable. The other thing I would like to address on that section is that not all charities are required or permits are required to file quarterly reports, as was stated earlier. Only permittees that have hit $50,000, I believe, and if the Department of Revenue wants to correct me on that, I believe it's $50,000 a quarter, are the only ones that are required by law to turn in a quarterly report. If they don't do $50,000 or if they don't report, now we're talking about 2 years where a charity would not have to report because they could just simply claim that we weren't doing $50,000 a quarter, whether they were or weren't or were not. So a two-year scenario opens up several holes that I'm not very comfortable with being in this industry. Finally, the one-hour session break, which is Section 9. First of all, this is not a statute. It is a regulation. And this particular regulation was introduced and adopted at the request of the industry, an example of our commitment to self-regulating. This regulation was put in place to prevent the exploitation of the bingo session payout limitations of $5,000 per session. Bingo halls in the past would routinely offer $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 or more sessions and claim that they were simply running sessions concurrently. In addition to sidestepping the spirit of the law, these concurrent sessions created an auditing nightmare for the nonprofits and the state. The competition to offer these large-scale sessions and the inevitable price wars that resulted from them nearly destroyed bingo operations in Anchorage. It is my understanding that this section of the bill was included under the auspices that remote community bingo halls suffer because players do not want to wait around for an hour to play again. In the 16 years I have been in this industry and throughout my extensive travels to various villages and remote bingo halls, I have never heard of this complaint. If anything, I would feel that the one-hour break between sessions gives you an opportunity to make more money either through your snack bar sales, vending, pull tab sales, and so on and so forth. The proponents of HB 477 and specifically Section 9 may be pushing another agenda that opens the door for an unprecedented expansion of gaming. If this section passes, it will move us one step closer to the use of Class 2 electronic bingo machines. These are essentially slot machines that could be played under the umbrella of concurrent bingo sessions 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It is my understanding that that machines of this nature are already in Alaska, warehoused and ready to go, and the Department of Revenue has been continually pressured to approve their use. Section 9 moves these machines a little closer to the warehouse exit door. My opinions on this bill were formed after numerous conversations with my peers and others in the industry and as a result of my extensive experience in Alaska's charitable gaming industry. Although I do not represent all the organizations I've spoken with in an official capacity, I'm expressing their cumulative opinions. I do, however, represent and speak on behalf of several native nonprofit organizations whose gaming permits I am tasked with managing. Please stop this bill, HB 477, and I thank you for your consideration. Does anyone have any questions for me?
Are there any questions? Seeing none, Jack? Mr. Powers.
Operator, license number 022, and I'm presently, I think this is the third or fourth task force I've been on in 20 years, so I'd like to read my testimony, and I may read it a little bit slower because of my breathing situation, so please bear with me. I want to start by saying that I support Steve. Excuse me, Steve, but I'm going to butcher your last name again. Steve's testimony. I support Steve's testimony 100%. And I don't want to get too redundant, so I'll have a brief statement. Between his organization and mine, we probably represent the largest MVP and the largest operator in the state of Alaska. Now, on that note, while the department is sitting there, maybe they can answer this question when I'm done, but I would be interested to find out from the Department of Revenue exactly, out of the 22 operators, how many are large operators? How many exist in the state? By large, I mean how many operators that are fully bonded and have contracts with at least four permittees. I would venture to guess that there are very few. Now, getting back to HB 477, as far as involving the state troopers at the front end of a gaming investigation, this bill, in essence, would make it possible for anyone to claim anything, and the troopers would have to investigate it. They would have no choice. A simple phone call from an anonymous caller would require an investigation if this passes, regardless of whether the claim seems credible or not. Not to mention the key regulator involved in gaming, the Department of Revenue. They may not even be in the loop before the investigation is initiated by a secret call or email to the troopers. The Department of Revenue are the experts in gaming. On the other hand, the state troopers are not as informed about gaming laws and individuals in this gaming industry as the department is. So it seems that this bill puts the cart before the horse. Moreover, the bill supposedly intends to clean up gaming with this provision. But then at the same time, it loosens all the reporting requirements upon which the prosecution depends on. There is nothing to stop an unscrupulous individual from intentionally not reporting via quarterly reports and then have 2 years before the department catches any mistakes. Some are saying that the annual audits are just too time-consuming and too expensive for most charities. Well, that would be just as, it would be just as expensive for biannually rather than annually. The auditor would charge by the amount of work, so 2 years worth of audits would cost twice as much. I don't see any savings there. Now, also addressing the bingo sessions, I see, I'm hoping Larry Crawford, Representative Crawford, is sitting back in there, but if not, but I see removing the one-hour break in between sessions as a mistake in many, many ways. Bingo players use that hour for various reasons: to go to the potty, grab a bite to eat, play a few pool tabs, and socialize with each other. Without the hour break, I see businesses, bingo business, pool tab businesses, running nonstop 24 hours a day. I think it will open the door to setting up bingo machines, which could be set up anywhere. I visualize from my experience in this industry, and I see bingo machines set up right next to a pool tab kiosk in the middle of a mall. While I appreciate the intent of HB 477 because of the manner in which it is written, it will create more issues than it will solve. Now, addressing some of Bob Lozier's comments, I don't know of any operations, I say operations because everybody uses operations and operators improperly in this industry, but the state has always given us yellow cards. I don't know of anybody that was never opened up on January 1st because they haven't done they haven't got their permits or licenses. The state has always given them us temporarily if they are behind schedule. And unless the individual permittee or operator or operation had reasons, you know, the state had solid reasons for them not to be issued. The annual report, I mean, that's easy. And it was discussed by Representative Roford. It's just a compilation of the four quarterly reports tied together. And speaking of the time of it all, my goodness, the annual report's really not due until March 15th. I believe that's, what, 65 or 85 days out after the first of the year. So, you know, there's plenty of time there to have a CPA review. And, of course, speaking of the annual report, that must be accompanied by an independent CPA review. The quarterly reports aren't done with a CPA. I see some problems there. And then I guess the last thing is, if you're running a larger large-scale operation such as a bingo hall, you just can't run it with volunteers. You have to have independent audits and comptrollers and cameras in the ceiling. It is a business. It's a real, some of it's a fairly large business. So I guess that's the end of my statement. And hopefully you received that via fax. Everybody has it in front of them. And I didn't want to be redundant, but I do want to remind you that I agree with Steve's written statement 100% also. I'm going to be available for any questions and answers. Stay online. And oh, one last thing I did forget, you know, the one-hour session, my goodness. Mr. Lozier says about once every 3 months they want to do a second session. So it's really not that inconvenient, you know. Any questions? And I'm here. Oh, by the way, does the department, Mr. Prather or Mr. Myers, have an idea how many large operators there are out of the 22?
Thank you, Jack. Maybe we can get that. Jack, you indicated that if we go to remove the one-hour session, you believe you can go to bingo games 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. How can you do that when there's a current restriction on the number of games, the number of prizes you can pay, and the number of sessions?
Well, I mean, you're allowed to have up to 35 bingo sessions per, 35 bingo games per session. So, you know, and we're allowed to have four sessions a day. So if you have a slow-moving operation, certainly dependent on the games, you know, some bingo games, a simple straight bingo, just four numbers across where the middle free spot you get for free, you can do that in 8 or 9 minutes. And then we can have a coverall that would take up to an hour. If you do a blackout coverall, that could last a whole hour, one game. So if I had, hypothetically, 35 blackouts, you know, coveralls, that's 35 hours. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me, except in my recent experience playing bingo, in a small community with 22 people, you played straight bingo, the people were there bingoing in 8 and 9 numbers, we were done in 2 to 3 minutes. It went fairly quick. But secondly, on the coverall, generally, at least from my recollection and recent, again, experience, because there was nothing else to do in that community, the coverall was a game that people enjoyed playing because it had a bigger prize associated with it. So if you restricted it on the number of the prizes, I mean, if you have 35 coveralls, it kind of takes away the fun out of it. But I don't know. Representative Roberg, do you have a question?
No, sir.
Mr. Lynn?
No, sir.
Well, Jack, thank you very much for your testimony. I look forward to playing bingo at your facility one day when I get old and decrepit and can't walk. Maybe give me something to do.
Now, let me comment on that. See, that's part of the bingo stigma out there.
Maybe I ought to make an appointment.
Bingo is not a bunch of little old ladies with gray hair daubing, you know? I mean, you come to some of the bingo halls in Anchorage, sir, and on a Friday and Saturday night, we've got the younger crowd. You only have to be 19 to play bingo. I mean, it's not just little old ladies daubing. It's there's younger and younger people playing every day. And wouldn't you rather have them young people sitting in a nice, clean, drug-free work bingo hall with no alcohol than being up around the corner at a bar?
If they were 19, yes, sir.
There you go. Well, I mean, come to the bingo hall. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Thank you, Jack.
All right. I'm going to stay online. Thank you.
All righty. All right. I guess we'll go to Gregory Peterson. Ketchikan.
Thank you very much. My name is Gregory Peterson. Through the chair. Sorry. And I'm the general manager of Alaska Indoor Sports Distributing, and I First of all, I'd like to say that I greatly appreciate the testimony of Mr. Steve Borkerding and Mr. Jack Powers. And I'll try also not to be too redundant. I would, however, like to address the testimony that was brought up earlier. I guess I'm confused. Apparently, it's not illegal to steal money from charities. I got a little lost there. But anyway, back to my testimony. Department of point one, the Department of Public Safety mandate, I believe, is the gaming unit does a great job enforcing the rules and regulations of the gaming industry, and that no change, therefore, is needed. If it is felt otherwise by some, then any mandate to review or investigate should stay within the gaming unit, just as the Department of Public Safety already must investigate in the case of theft or embezzlement. Point two, the one-year versus two-year application process for permittees. We want the Department of Revenue to review both licenses and permittees on an annual basis. This is one of just a few occasions the gaming unit has to review whether or not licensees or permittees are in compliance. Good, solid process and should not change. Point three, and on this point, this is the two-year versus one-year reporting for operators. This bill only covers operators. There are only 22 operators in the state. There are 1,200 permittees, as Steve pointed out, and only 22 operators. This bill only covers operators. And also to address another point, quarterlies are very general. There's no reconciliation process. There are no bank statements sent into the state. However, annuals are a much more rigorous process, not simply a compilation of four quarterlies. And we do not want to go backwards in this industry. Gaming industry has always been in favor of tighter regulations. This section loosens existing regulations, and for the most part, the gaming industry would not benefit from loosened regulations. The overview of annual reports is an important process in this industry. Making it a looser, freer process would just lead to bigger problems, and you know, operators run amok now have 2 years to steal money from charities. It's happened in the past, and we're just opening the door for it to happen again. Point four, removing the one-hour requirement between bingo sessions. First of all, I see this as an attempt to create a small loophole in the current regulations in order to expand gaming in Alaska. There's a very subtle understanding of the regulations is needed here to see what's going on. Secondly, you may hear that some bush communities want this requirement removed. In the 10 years I've been in this industry working with permittees across the state, I have never heard anyone complain about the one-hour restriction between bingo sessions. Again, I urge you not to allow this bill to go any further than this committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Any questions? Oh, now turn to the state troopers, Lieutenant Helgo.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Yes, sir. For the record, this is James Helgo. I'm a lieutenant with the Department of Public Safety Division of the Alaska State Troopers. And our concern with this legislation, the way that it is written, is found in Section 1. And I apologize, but I only have Version A. But I believe the part that I'm concerned about is probably still consistent in Version G, where it reads, the Department of Public Safety shall investigate any report of theft or embezzlement by a permittee, operator, employee, or consumer. As written, this would make the Department of Public Safety Division of Alaska State Troopers the investigating agency for all thefts and embezzlement by a permittee, operator, employee, or consumer, regardless of local police jurisdictions or the credibility of the complaint. DPS feels it would be a better use of resources to allow the existing local law enforcement agencies, along with the Department of Revenue task force, to investigate this alleged criminal misconduct. DPS would investigate when asked and where there is no local law enforcement agency. And that concludes my testimony. I would be available to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Roper?
Yeah, through the chair, Lieutenant, you said relying on local enforcement. Wouldn't they, can a local jurisdiction enforce state law and unless they had their own ordinance that there would be a criminal statute or ordinance?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, local law enforcement agencies such as the Fairbanks Police Department, the Anchorage Police Department, or Seward Police Department, for example, enforce state statute on a regular basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant. I think that concludes the sign-up sheets. Anyone else here wish to testify? Anybody else online? Seeing or hearing none, did you want to make some?
Just a point of clarification, Mr. Chairman. Mike O'Hare, staff for Representative Peacott. It's been brought to my attention there's a question regarding the requirements for prosecuting in Section 1, page 1, line 6 and 7, excuse me. These investigations and prosecutions relate to permittees, operators, employees, and consumers, not just to the operators. Sorry, just point of clarification.
I believe the Lieutenant pointed that out as
Thank
well.
You.
Okay. With that, then, we'll, since we don't have a quorum, we can't do anything with this, so we'll just hold it over.
Mr. Chairman, I was just very impressed with the level of support for your legislation.
Huh?
I was very impressed with the level of support for your bill here.
A lot of support. Okay, with that, then we will go to the next matter. Thank you for those who have come forward today. We'll take up House Bill 51, which we've had before this committee previously. Ish.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Pulowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer. As we had last left it, the committee, I believe, had adopted for discussion purposes the proposed committee substitute to House Bill 51, and we were waiting for testimony from the Director of the Division of Insurance. In the interim, I believe in your packets, letters of support from the State Chamber of Commerce and the Alaska Chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association should have been added to your packets as well. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I was...
Yeah. Is that the S version that we had before?
We have the S version. And we are receiving the letters from Alaska Chapter of National Electric Contractors Association indicating their warm support. Okay. You wish to make any additional comments, or is that?
Mr. Chairman, not at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has on the S version.
Any questions? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else here in Juneau that wish to testify in the matter? Okay, then we'll go to the teleconference line. Linda, are you there? Madam Director.
I was just unmuted.
Okay.
I'm Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. And particularly given the time, Mr. Chairman, I will try to keep my comments fairly short. I do appreciate the time to comment on this CS, and I appreciate holding this over for my comments. I would like to start by acknowledging the efforts of the group that is promoting this legislation to include more specific financial requirements for self-insured associations. I'm going to limit my comments today to some general concepts and attempt not to delve into the minutiae of a 20-page bill. I will pick some specific areas, and I'll, as always, be happy to answer any questions. And if I, and I don't care if anybody has questions and you want to interrupt me as I go through, please feel free to do so. I'm going to talk about a couple just general areas, financial oversight, and I'm going to try not to repeat anything that I said on the previous version of the bill, which was in Title 23, since it's now back in my title. As we all know, one of the basic principles of insurance regulation is financial oversight to ensure that claims get paid. The CS before you today does include far more detailed requirements, but I still have concerns about the bottom line repercussions of insolvency. There's a new term. I'm sorry, I'm not sure that we actually got the amendments, but I know that Mr. Pawlowski had indicated to me they were going to add the term tangible to net worth. My concern is there's still no definition of what tangible net worth is. Insurance regulation limits the types of assets and the valuation of those assets in determining an insurer's financial position. The quality of assets and liquidity is a concern to me. I still feel the $5 million net worth aggregate is excessively low. The Department of Labor has projected that on adjusted for inflation, from the time that $5 million was set as a requirement for individual single employer self-insured, would today be about $10 million. And I think Mr. Lesanke has already provided evidence that the average and median net worth of current self-insured employers is substantially higher. There is a requirement in this particular version for a solvency bond. I understand the it looks on paper like something that will be beneficial, but in reality, I'm not sure this is really practical. I've spent some time discussing the availability of this type of bond with a bond underwriter who's currently very active in the Alaska bond market. He has indicated to me that it will be very difficult to obtain this type of a bond, particularly because you're relying on a group of members who have not been required to provide audited financial statements, provide reviewed statements, or even their own financial statements supported by tax returns. If the association is to be the principal on the bond, there has to be a corporate signer who agrees to indemnify the bonding company. And usually in an association, it's difficult to find someone who has that kind of authority. One of the concepts that I'm still finding confusing is the actual working of financial responsibility. Most of the bill provides that the association is a responsible party for payment of benefits due to employees under the work comp title. But the indemnity agreement in 77010 is between the members. Generally, trade associations don't have the kinds of assets that would enable them to provide the payment of work comp benefits, but this bill places primary responsibility on the association. And the members are required to do a joint and several liability agreement, but there's nothing about the association. Termination of membership. There are a number of details which I thought were very good under which a member could terminate or be terminated. The conditions, however, deal with the going forward mechanisms for providing benefits for their employees, but they don't address what happens to the liabilities, either the employer's own or their joint and several liabilities, for the time they were part of the association. There's a section that deals with insufficient assets and circumstances in which the association would be considered insolvent, but there's no provision for a solution after that. There's no provision for a receivership, for wrap-up affairs. It says the director can withdraw the certificate, but then what? It doesn't say what happens. There is a requirement that the security deposit be retained for 36 months in the event of termination. I would suggest that that's not an appropriate length of time. Work comp claims, I think, as we're all have become aware through various other discussions of work comp, have very long tails and can take 20 or more years. It would seem more appropriate to condition the release of a deposit upon termination of liabilities as determined through actuarial analysis. The other major area, I'd just like to mention a couple things, still deals with regulatory oversight. Chapter 36 of the insurance title is and controls trade practices and frauds. Includes things like oversight of marketing, misrepresentation, unfair discrimination, unfair claim settlement practices. Section in the bill 2177-220 would not allow any of these parts of the insurance title to apply to the self-insured associations. The CS also provides for third-party administrator to administer claims. Today, the Division of Insurance licenses adjusters who handle work comp claims. Title 23 provides that an individual self-insured employer may do one of two things. They may either have their own staff adjust claims, or they can use an independent licensed third party to adjust claims. This bill does not require the licensing as an adjuster of the third-party administrator, and therefore there wouldn't be any oversight of the claims handling practices. These are just a couple of the oversight things that I wanted to point out, because again, there's no real complaint process, there's no authority to require accountability in the handling of claims. And as I pointed out the last time I testified, we do certainly see instances of injured workers not being treated according to statutory requirements. Most of this CS appears to be based on the Nevada statutes and regs. I have tried to do some comparison just for myself, that I'm going to go into, but there are some significant provisions in Nevada that appear to have been left out of this bill. There, as I mentioned earlier, I saw an issue with the indemnity agreement does include the association. There is an annual assessment requirement of a minimum of $300,000 or an amount that the director would determine to be satisfactory based on an annual review of actuarial solvency. So the regulator has input into solvency up front. That statute states that each member of the association, while you have an aggregate, each member must have a minimum of $250,000 tangible net worth and a minimum work comp premium of at least $10,000. I have no idea what the members of these groups have on either of those, net worth or premiums. It also applies that the chief regulator would approve annual assessments, much as we approve rate filings in the regulated industry today. So again, there is a different level of oversight. It's also a critical piece to me that in the Nevada regulation, there are provisions made to assess other self-insured associations for the claims obligations of an insolvent association. I'm still concerned if one of these self-insured groups becomes insolvent, somebody's going to have to pay, and I think we maybe need to talk about who that is. I'm not going to repeat my testimony about reciprocals, but I would like to reiterate that I think the reciprocal has some requirements and has some oversight that I'm still not hearing anything that I understand why the reciprocal wouldn't work. The reasons I've been given for the desirability of a self-insured program have been things like the ability to have safety programs, to have control over their own insurance-type programs, potential for cost savings, other types of things. Any of the objectives that I've heard associated with the self-insured association work comp plan can still be accomplished through the formation of a reciprocal. So I would still really like to hear something on that. I will conclude, it's still not my intent to try to be negative. I'm really pleased to see the efforts to include more accountability in this CS. I continue to have reservations about the viability of these small plans. When the downside of there not being sufficient money to pay claims of injured workers exists, I would urge you to carefully consider the possible effects of the legislation. This CS has been crafted with great care, time, and expense by Alaska Trade Group, who's really attempting to find a viable alternative and behave responsibly. The bill, however, would apply to any group who decide to participate who might not have the same values of accountability, but would merely be looking for a way to skimp on workers' compensation costs. I think we've all seen an increase, and I hear it, and each of you on this committee hear from your constituents about the cost of workers' compensation insurance. I think that's prompting a lot of support for an alternative mechanism. But I think before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, we really need to look at the ramifications. And with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Linda. You got right underneath the timeline. Appreciate your testimony. The questions? Representative Roeckberg?
Mr. Chairman, Linda, have you reduced your critique to writing for the sponsor and the association and the committee?
My critique, meaning?
Your testimony today and the points you brought.
I do have my testimony in writing.
Yeah, that'd be very helpful, I think, for everyone if we could.
I would be happy to do that, Representative Roeckberg. I would also indicate that the last time I testified, the chair, Representative Anderson at the time, asked for some comparisons, and I had my staff do that. But subsequent to that time, we did a comparison based on the earlier version that was in Title 23, so it's not very applicable. I have asked that that comparison be updated, and I will be trying to provide that to you also. But I will be happy to forward this. I would forward it. I'm assuming you'd like me to forward it to Josh Appleby as the staff for the committee? Or do you want me to send it to each of you individually, which I can also do?
Representative Roeckberg, your pleasure.
I'll send it to Josh, and he can distribute it to the committee members and to the sponsor.
And, okay.
That might be just as easily. Mr. Chairman, just to pursue the one area, is it correct that if you formed a reciprocal today, that the net worth requirement is still just $5 million in the statute? Is that what you testified to?
Through the chair, Representative Roeckberg, there is no net worth requirement. There are capital and surplus requirements for a reciprocal. Those are to begin $1.5 million, and as on an ongoing basis, a reciprocal is required to have $1,375,000 in capital and surplus. So there is no net worth requirement, but it's a capital, so you have a liquid amount of money to as a backdrop for the operations of the reciprocal.
Through the chair, Ms. Hall, I thought I had the impression there was where did the $5 million figure come from? Is that just the amount expressed in this legislation before us, or is there another?
The $5 million figure, I believe it is in the legislation before you as one of the requirements to be eligible to form a self-insured association work comp group, but it came from the work comp statutes. It's a requirement today. It's the minimum requirement for an individual employer to be considered for a self-insurance certificate.
Okay. But your testimony was that that is an older, either statutory or regulatory requirement, that if it was adjusted for inflation, it would be twice as much? Is that what your testimony was?
My testimony based on the information given to me by Director Lysanky. That was promulgated in 1983, I believe.
And, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hall, you indicated there was no specific provisions of the legislation before us that provided in the event there was an actual insolvency. So is that, I guess one of the concerns here is the guarantee funds and how that would be affected. So you see any linkage there, or is there a...
No linkage between the way this is set up and the guarantee fund, nor do I particularly think there should be. What I'm suggesting is there should be some method for determining what occurs in the case of an insolvency. Somebody will pay. Certainly there's the joint several liability agreements between the members of an individual association. Beyond that, there doesn't appear to be any other mechanism other than allowing the director to withdraw the certificate, but it doesn't say what do you do then. Where would funding come from? In reality, one of the problems we've run into even in the insured marketplace, when the couple years ago the guarantee fund was estimated to be running out of money to pay claims, and that obligation goes back to the individual employer. If that individual employer is bankrupt, we would probably have little course of action for the injured worker. If they're bankrupt, the lawsuit or any kind of litigation would not have any real, there would be no resource.
Well, through the chair, are there other provisions under like a certified self-insured or a reciprocal now? What happens in those instances?
The self-insureds under Title 23 for workers' compensation, I don't believe there are any such mechanisms. Director Lasanki would need to comment on that. The reciprocals come under the Guarantee Association today.
But do the reciprocals pay into the guarantee fund?
Yes, they do.
And there's no provision in this to provide for assessments to the guarantee fund?
No, but I think unless we're, through the chair, I'm sorry, Representative Roeckberg, unless we're dealing with what I will term, for lack of a better phrase, a level playing field, the regulated industry who have certain capital requirements and audit requirements and various things, I would not think it would be fair to include self-insureds in the same guarantee fund as the insured marketplace.
I agree. Mr. Chairman, last question, I think, here. Ms. Hall, you indicated there was a, you made a distinction there. You said there was a, the joint and,
Joint and several liability,
right. There was a provision in a portion of the construction of the bill, but not in another section, nothing about the, I think you said about the association?
The joint and several liability, as I read the bill, and I'm certainly not an attorney, but as I read the bill, the joint and several liability is between the members. The joint and several liability does not extend to the association, and yet the association has the obligation to pay the workers' compensation benefits of the employees of the members. So there seems to be something of a disconnect. And I did note in the Nevada statutes and regs, the association was included in that joint and several liability agreement.
Can you give us an example? I'm not sure I quite follow what how that works.
And several liability, and again, please don't take this as gospel legal opinion, but joint and several liability means if we have five employers, such as this association, employer A becomes bankrupt, employer B, C, D, and E are then also responsible not only for their own obligations to this self-insured association group, but they're responsible for the obligations of employer A, who can no longer pay his own. That is one of the prime concepts of this type of an arrangement, is that they agree to be responsible for each other, and they take on the financial responsibility of their other members. If the association is not part of that, and yet they have the responsibility for payment, there's no responsibility of the five members to pay for the obligations of the association. Do I sound like I'm talking in circles? I apologize.
No, it's close. That's what I was trying to. I understand the first portion, but if is this bill written where the association is responsible and therefore the joint and several of the individual members wouldn't come
They're not
play?
Tied together. That was the piece that I said I'm not quite sure how the actual working of the financial responsibility would take place because the association isn't tied into the joint and several liability in this bill. And yet they are responsible in several provisions for the payment of the work comp obligations.
You got that, Fish? Okay, thank you.
Pete.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a place where you can insure the group with reinsurance or some provision there to protect the group against individual bankruptcies?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I think that was the intent of the solvency bond, and yet as I talk to bond underwriters, they're fairly skeptical about the practicality of obtaining that. Typically, you cannot insure against bankruptcy. It's a financial risk. It's not an insurance risk, and that is kind of a fine distinction. But typically, that is not the subject of insurance. The association can buy excess insurance, and the bill does require that to occur in amounts as directed by the director. But normally, those have, they're called self-insured retention type programs. They're large deductibles. They can start with $250,000 or $100,000. Many of them are written with $1 million before that reinsurance actually kicks in. So it's that layer that the group has kept that they have to be responsible for themselves, and that's where the solvency issue comes in.
I don't know.
Representative Roper.
Ms. Hall, you indicated that your conversations with some underwriters in the state indicated there was the concept of a solvency bond was you questioned whether they're even going to be available here. Is there a way that the this group could prove that otherwise, or I would assume that they would have they could bring forward documentation that there is availability, but into what scope and so forth.
I would think, you know, that I don't know that. As I said, I talked to a bond underwriter that's very active in our marketplace and asked him about the availability and underwriting of such a this type of a bond. And I think the group certainly could talk to, they have been working with an agent who would have access to the marketplace who might be able to give a better answer to that question.
Linda, can you explain to me how Section 1 works? If you've got the bill.
I do.
It's dealing with the self-insurance certificates and that the director may issue blah, 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 self-insurance certificate. And then when you refer over to page 5 on line 3, it says that the director shall issue. So you've got a may, an operative word of may, and you got an operative word of shall. Can you tell me how those interchange and how they work?
Mr. Chairman, the best I can tell you is that the sponsor staff has told me they want to change on page 5 the shall to may so that those two are the same. I can't tell you how that would work when at one place it says the director may and another place.
Okay.
I don't know. I understand that's going to be proposed as an amendment to the bill so that there is consistency.
And you would rather see a may than a shall?
I think so that there's some discretion that would certainly be preferable. I think the discretion would have to be consistent and based on factual information, not just because the director didn't like the color of the shirt the particular applicant wore that day.
Well, I think that'd be entirely appropriate.
It was green, right?
It was green, and it was the same Patty's Day. You'd be okay. Are there additional questions for Ms. Hall? Director Lisinski, did you want to make any comments on any of the aspects of the bill that were addressed?
For the record, my name is Paul F. Lisinski. I'm the Director of Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The $5 million that was mentioned and Representative Rookberg asked about is in the board regulations that were passed in 1983. And just to tie it back to my earlier comments, the full board during a discussion about this topic had reflected and given me some direction to please propose some refreshment of some of the regs to bring them forward. And so one of the things that I intend to do to bring back to the board to see if they want to pass it as a regulation. And this would be applicable to the individual self-insurers, the single employers, would be to raise that amount to reflect the passage of time and inflation. And so the proposed reg will probably say $10 million as a minimum net tangible asset base for a single company. And then there's at least one other dollar value thing in the regulations that would probably also qualify for the same type of treatment. Our regulations require now that a security be at least $300,000, the security bond or cash value of whatever is put on security right now needs to be $300,000 as a minimum. And that would probably be $600,000 if we also adjust it to recognize the value of money over the last 23 years. So I just wanted to clarify that, but I don't have anything additional. I know it's late.
Is there a definition in any of your regulations or statutes that defines tangible net worth?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we do have in our regulations a definition of net tangible assets. I'm pretty certain that we do, because we were actually asked the question about why we didn't reference it in a different section of our regulation that just talked about net assets generically. And I believe that it was, you know, taken from, you know, some kind of a business tome. I don't think it was invented by the Workers' Compensation Board.
Do you think there's a difference between net worth, tangible net worth, and net tangible assets?
I would hesitate to say no, simply because I was asked by someone I think was smarter than me why I interpreted it the way that we did under our regulations, and they had a CPA after their name. So don't want to mislead you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Paul. Nope. Any questions? Representative Rugberg, not so easy.
Yep, Mr. Lysanky, through the chair, the bill refers to the issue of a security deposit, and the director pointed out the 36-month area. And you mentioned another term, I guess, under Title 23. What is that? Is there an equivalent, different nomenclature, definition, or a term that's equivalent to that?
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, what I was referring to is under the board's regulations, it gives the entity that's required to post the security a number of options about what they utilize to post as a security. So you can get, for example, a letter of credit might be acceptable, which is, you know, one form of security. You could purchase one of these security bonds that people have talked about. If you had, for example, if you had a certificate of deposit that was sufficient, say it was $300,000 and that was all that was at stake. We have procedures for allowing you to post that certificate of deposit and kind of put it in escrow, and in that way you continue to get the interest payable back to your entity. So it's kind of a relatively costless way of putting security on the books. So you will see in various areas that people can make distinctions about what type of security they're willing to accept and under what circumstances. That's what I was referring to.
Was that equivalent to what they're referring to in here as a security deposit?
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, it could be. If I understand the proposed bill, I think it gives the Division Director of Insurance a fair amount of leeway to talk about what would or would not be a sufficient security. And I believe that Director Hall was expressing some concerns about whether it had enough latitude or not. Those specific comments that Director Hall was talking about is a bond that would be kept so that if someone is no longer self-insuring, their liabilities down the road would be covered. And under our current regulations, the Workers' Compensation Board does not in all instances utilize that. And that's, I think, personally, is one of the weaknesses of our current regime over on our side.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lysanky, Is that the $300,000 in your regulation, or is that a different issue?
Yeah, in our through the chair, Representative Rookberg, in our regulation, it speaks the $300,000 is a security for an ongoing operation. For example, and we have a provision that if you cease being a self-insured entity, that the board can ask you to leave on the books a security such as that. And what we do not have, and I think it's, as I mentioned just a minute ago, I think it's not a good thing. What we do not have currently is what you're seeing in this proposal, which is specifically making everyone have a deposit that could be kept on for some greater or lesser time. As I said in my earlier testimony a couple weeks ago, these regulations were developed for very large entities, and I think there was some belief at that time that a very large entity, by its very largeness, didn't pose the risks of insolvency. And I don't personally believe in that, and I think there's a lot of good reasons for none of us to relax just because General Motors is big. If they lose enough money, they can fall just like anybody else.
So, Mr. Chairman, it would be fair to say that this bill, by proposing the security deposit, it's a little more forward-thinking than the current regulations are? It just is an issue of the length of time and maybe the amount?
I would say that it has – that aspect is better than what we are doing currently with the large self-insurers. And that would be something that I would seek to improve on our side.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Paul. Anyone else wish to testify? And if not, we'll close public testimony. And Rich, I want to call you up here. I had a question, and maybe you're not the one to ask. Maybe it's Linda. On page 11, it talks about the annual audits, and it goes on to suggest who performs it. But it doesn't have any disposition of the audit. Is there somewhere else in the bill that says what the disposition of that audit shall be? Now, the director determines who does it, on whom, but the report itself, I don't see any disposition. Where does it go? Or does it go to anybody?
Mr. Chairman, for the record again, this is Michael Pulowski. You're asking, does the audit get reported back to the division?
Yes.
I believe we also have Robert Vogel online, but if I recall correctly.
Linda, are you there, and do you know the answer to the question off the top of your head? You probably read this 10 times.
I am here, and I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I would assume that I got the audits, or the director got the audits, but I don't believe that's specifically stated here. But there are some implications as you get into some other provisions about objections to classifications and things like that that would kind of imply that those audits went someplace. I believe they are audits intended to make sure payroll is being reported accurately and assessments, therefore, are being made to make sure that the assessments cover the obligation of each employer.
Mr. Rookberg.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It might be appropriate to specify in the section there where the audits are to be forwarded.
That's what
to.
I'm wondering if it's if I've missed it and it's not specified.
It seems like
else.
The membership would be first and foremost interested in what their other associates are doing, right?
And, Mr. Chairman, I do believe, and Representative Rookberg through the chair, that all of those are required when the certificate is granted in the first place. And then there is a provision in the bill that allows the director to audit the books at the expense of the association. And I'm trying to find that in here. And we're not opposed to cleaning up and, I mean, where the intent is there, absolutely. The other side, Mr. Chairman, and I would direct everyone to page 15, lines 26 and 27, the always effort of the imperfect in trying to set up a system is the reliance on granting the director regulation authority to implement the provisions of these chapters. Not that that's ever completely adequate, but we look forward to working with the director to develop the system correctly.
It's the punt provision.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, though, I mean, if I could, I'd ask if Robert Vogel's available. He might be able to direct me where in the legislation the question, your question, could be answered.
Mr. Vogel, are you online?
Oh, there we go. This is Robert Vogel, for the record.
Robert, can you direct us to maybe where in the legislation, since it's primarily taken from Nevada, what is the disposition of the annual audit?
The annual audits of the payroll of the members is handled by the group, with subject to audit generally by the Division of Insurance. It does not specify that here, and probably could be cleaned up, but the association is required to audit through the section you were reading, to ensure the correct classification, the correct payrolls and assessments are collected. And if they are deficient, then they'll be receiving a bill from the association to correct that. And if they've overpaid, then they'll be receiving a refund.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might add, I believe the area you're looking for is on page 10 between lines 4 and 25. That's the annual statement of financial condition. It's done by a certified public accountant, must be filed within 120 days after the conclusions of the association's fiscal year, must contain information, claims, actuarial opinions, reserves. The director may require, and this is C on 20 and 21, the filing of other reports necessary to carry out the provisions of this section, including. And so that is the annual report that goes back to the director.
Mr. Chairman, as long as you have Mr. Bogle online, sir, did you hear the testimony of Director Hall?
Yes, sir, I did.
And do you know what she's referring to? And she says that there appears to be some, using the Nevada template, which you're familiar with, that there's some either omissions or things that are included there that are not included in this committee substitute?
There are. In the Nevada structure, there's the Nevada Administrative Code that, after the regulations, which these were modeled after, were passed, that assisted the commissioner in firming up some of the areas that the Commissioner Hall spoke about. And that was sort of the intent here, is let's put into the framework something that we know works in other areas, and then work with the commissioner to implement the, as Mr. Pulaski said, to the regulations to administer these in some of these areas. So there are some things that are missing, but they were in our administrative code, not in our regulations, which the commissioner may change from time to time rather than going through the legislative purview. This sets out the framework for her to do that.
Chairman, Ms. Bogle, what about the issue she brought up about the, if in fact there was a failure or bankruptcy, there's no statutory provisions for disposition of outstanding claims other than the 36-month security deposit or something. I mean, what about that issue?
And that goes back to the joint and several. If the group is insolvent and unable to pay its assets, the director can force and require the group to assess the members for those additional assets. Obviously, if everybody is bankrupt, that's probably not going to happen, but that's also where the solvency bond comes in. And in operating groups for the last 10 years, generally those solvency bonds are available through our excess carriers as a condition of the excess carrier.
It's an additional protection feature that is able to be purchased through the excess carrier and their bond underwriters. And we've had those for years on our groups in Nevada, and I know that other states have them too, until such time as the group has enough assets, they start posting letters of credit and other securities and can do away with the cost of the solvency bond. So those are the protection mechanisms. You also have, other areas to protect. The excess insurance is one of those. It is, like the commissioner said, kind of a deductible. It's the layer of risk that the group takes. And currently, of the groups that we manage, the highest retention we have is $750,000. Our builders group has a $50,000 retention. We have a $500,000 retention. Most excess carriers won't go below $500,000 today, so that's generally the lowest you can go. Years ago, in the soft market, groups were buying $100,000 retentions, but we can't get that anymore. But also, as a group ages and grows, it's not intended to just have five members. It intends to grow and add, good, strong, solvent members, add premium volume, assessment volume, add tangible net worth to the equation, so that one member going bankrupt, unable to pay its bills, isn't going to impact the group. And if our actuaries are doing their jobs and we have the appropriate oversight by these regulations, we're going to be collecting enough assessments from them in advance to cover those projected liabilities. That's the intent, of course, but that's why we have those other protections in there, the joint and several, the solvency bonds or other securities that have to get posted.
Any further questions? Seeing none. Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Thank you. I'll remain online if there are any other questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you want to take up these amendments?
We'll take up the amendments this time. I don't think there's anyone else here.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
Okay, let's...
Don't worry, here it's not in the resources.
Amendment number one to page one, line 14, offered by Representative Rokeberg. Is there an objection to amendment number one? Representative Crawford?
No, sir. No objection.
No objection.
No objection. All right. Amendment number one passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Amendment number two offered by Representative Rokeberg.
I so move.
Is there objection to the amendment to page 5, line 5?
No objection.
Relation shall be made, which conforms to page 1. Hearing no objection, amendment number 2 is adopted. Representative Roper, you have more amendments?
No, sir. That's all I have.
Jeez.
Want to take a brief at ease?
You want to write some more amendments?
No.
You want to take a brief at ease?
Yes.
Okay, take a brief, please.
I move CS for sponsor substitute for House Bill 51 S version as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection, Representative Crawford?
No objection.
Nope.
You're not objecting?
Not objecting.
Okay.
Don't keep trying to get one.
Hearing no objection, then the bill's moved.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Only if Fish promises to fix it.
Yeah.
And